So I'm teaching these 14, 15 year olds, and I don't know if you know anything about teenagers, but they're dumb and they don't like to read.
And absolutely hate teenagers. Glad I never was one.
Me too.
Welcome everybody to the 8th episode of the Writerings podcast, because I came prepared and I checked, and this is 8. My name is Greg.
And I'm Martin.
And we welcome Aaron to the show.
Thank you.
On this episode, who graciously agreed to donate a lot of his time to us, because it's been a rough few weeks trying to set this up, and we are again sorry.
Let's not forget adding a lot of patience.
Yes, indeed. But before we jump into the questions, of which I have many, because I have your website in front of me, and you are a fascinating guy. But first, I want to take a
deep
moment.
Deep breaths, Aaron. Deep breaths.
Yeah, it's going to be painless if you let it.
Okay.
But I wanted to take a moment to address kind of some sad news. Stan Lee passed away.
Yeah.
Of course.
And
I mean, for you especially, you're a massive Marvel fan, so
yes. Yes,
that's
I am.
Probably impacted you quite a bit.
But beyond Marvel, it's
so many creative people have taken their inspiration from him, and he's touched so many lives around the world over several years, and it's just a massive, massive loss to the creative world, I think.
Yes, and I thought that I don't think any of us would be here without Stan, either directly or indirectly. I was thinking that it would be a fitting tribute if we could just recount like one instance that Stan's work kind of touched us in any way. It doesn't have to be big, or it doesn't have to be defining. It's just recount a single memory.
Okay, who's gonna start?
Oh yeah, who goes first?
Well, whoever speaks first goes first.
Well, I guess I'll go. I'm a big comics fan myself. I actually started out with Spider-Man, and yeah, like my first comic I ever got was a Spider-Man comic. And I think Spider-Man's probably been my favorite comic book character since then. I mean, I will admit Batman's up there, but it's always been Spider-Man for me. And Peter Parker, Miles Morales, like, they're both fantastic. My Stan Lee memory. Years ago, in a English class at college, professor was like, well, who is your favorite writer ever? And I couldn't come up with, I was like, I don't know, but I can tell you who my favorite character is ever, and it's Spider-Man. And then I had to write an explanation about why this, you know, I mean, ridiculous in quotation marks comic book character is a why I would consider it a literary character. And so I went through and I found a bunch of interviews with Stan Lee, and I like quoted him and basically proved my point with his words. So that was pretty cool.
Definitely. For me, I think my introduction to the Marvel Universe was probably the animated X-Men show. Used to watch that on Saturday morning TV years ago when I was a kid. And as I say, that was my introduction to the concept of the Marvel Universe and these interconnected universes where things, characters from their own stories come in, and they come in and out of the X-Men's universe, and they interact with them, and just the concept of all of these characters with all of these wide-ranging abilities, and they've all got their own agendas and their own motivations, and you've got these two sides where you've got the Brotherhood of Mutants and the X-Men, but then you've also got Charles Xavier and Magneto, who don't actually hate each other per se.
Yeah,
they're old friends, and they've got this bond of friendship, and yet they're just on two different sides of the same ideological coin. Mm-hmm. And it's just everything about it just fascinated me and drew me in so much, and that is probably my main Stan Lee memory.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with both of you. I mean, I too grew up with Spider-Man, and obviously the big appeal, I think, for young kids is that he was the first superhero, admittedly, who was a teenage boy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just identifying with his struggles, and that the comics were equal part about fighting supervillains and the equal part about just maintaining a teenage boy's life. That was something that I identified with. But my memory is actually came after his passing, because obviously the internet has been flooded with memorials and quotes and all those stuff. And I found one that I think it's the most touching thing I read in a good while. And it goes like, I used to be embarrassed because I was just a comic book writer while other people were building bridges or going on to medical careers. And then I began to realize entertainment is one of the most important things in people's lives. Without it, they might go off the deep end. I feel if you are able to entertain, you're doing a good thing. And that's a thought that often comes up in our profession. Let's face it. Like, what do you do? I'm a writer. Yeah, but what do you do for work? I think we all had those kinds of conversations. And but yes, Stan is right. It's being an entertainer, being a writer, and it doesn't matter if it's comic books, if it's novels, especially writing genre fiction. It used to be looked down upon, and but it entertains people, and that's tremendously important.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Definitely.
So rest in peace, Stan, and thank you for everything. And Excelsior, obviously.
Excelsior, yeah.
So back to you, Aaron.
Okay.
Like I said, I have your website in front of me, and I will put obviously all kinds of links and stuff in the show notes, or liner notes. I learned that term recently, but tell us a little bit about yourself. Where do you come from? What do you do?
I live in Omaha, Nebraska right now. Spent a good chunk of my childhood living in various trailer parks up and down the Mississippi River. Got a handful of degrees in writing and teaching, and now I write and I teach here in Omaha. Yeah, I mean, I don't know anything specific. Was that good, or do you need more?
Yeah, no, it's.
Do you teach writing?
What's that?
Do you teach writing?
I do. I teach I teach a creative writing class at the high school here, Bellevue West, and I teach a writing class at the University of Nebraska as well. And then I also teach a filmmaking class, and I run the I'm the co-head of the journalism department at Bellevue West, so I run the yearbook and keep the website maintained and all that stuff. So it sounds like a lot of work.
Awesome.
But yeah, it's fun. I enjoy it.
Yeah, that's always the point. It's, if you are not enjoying it, then you might as well not be doing it, because
right.
What's the point? So we started out when I first invited you on the show on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really know, you know, what we would be talking about. And you said that you're a horror writer, and
yeah,
that's
I mean, we rarely know what we're talking about anyway. Greg never does.
True enough. That's why we invite people who do know what they are doing and do know what they are talking about to mask our lack of knowledge, or my lack of knowledge mostly. But yeah, let's start there. Like, what drew you to horror, and why are you working in this genre and not, I don't know, whatever else?
Yeah, well, I could tell you, when I was like 5 years old, I had this notebook, and in it I just drew monster after monster after, and I would like, and some of them would be like, oh, this is a vampire, and this is a zombie, and this is a mummy, and then I would just make up monsters, and I'd write little bios, like, this guy does this, or, you know, whatever. Anyway, my parents found it and they threw it away and told me it was evil.
Well, that's a bit harsh.
Yeah. And that had the, I think it had the opposite effect of what they wanted, because it just made me want to do it even more. So now, even when I write something that's not like, I don't go into it and think, okay, I'm going to write a scary story. Even when I don't do that, something scary happens in it. Like my novellas that are graphic novels and prose, like combined, there's a part in it where the main character basically goes to hell for a little bit. It's like, man, I just can't get away from it. Whatever I write, it just pops out.
Maybe we should get you to rewrite 50 Shades then. Now that
what's
I
that?
Would read. maybe we should get you to rewrite 50 Shades.
Oh, oh my God. I don't know. It's already been
now
done.
That I would read.
Maybe I'd give it a shot. Let's see.
What fascinates me about horror writers and the horror genre is you kind of, from an outsider perspective, you have your jobs cut out for you, because we are just so very impervious to those kind of primal instincts that used to work. Like I would assume that horror writers 50 or 100 years ago, or even more, had it a lot easier, perhaps, because the audience wasn't so overwhelmed with badly overdone and badly done horror, like in mostly in movies, and I'm thinking about the 80s and the early 90s, when
yeah,
everything was just put more gore in it, just put
yeah,
more blood in it, and we just became, how do you make, and that leads me to my question, like, how do you make a story scary. How do you instill fear when we have such high thresholds for it?
Well, I think it it goes back to H.P. Lovecraft's quote, the oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear, and the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown, right? So, because, you know, whatever you can imagine in your head is scarier than what's actually there. So I think as a writer of horror, you have to keep that in mind. And I'm not saying you never reveal the villain, you know, but if you can always keep the reader, the audience, or whatever, guessing about, maybe not even necessarily what's going on, but like the point behind it too. Like I think back to, like, you know, I know you were talking about like slasher movies, like Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street, and they're absolutely played out, you know, and Halloween is a masterpiece, you know, but there's been so many of them, it's like, it's kind of cliche now. But I go back to 1996, I think. Wes Craven made Scream. Have you ever seen Scream?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a slasher. It's just a slasher movie, right? But like, and the blood and gore is there. It's everywhere. But it's unnerving. And because you don't know who's doing it. You don't know why it's going on. And there are all these different red herrings. And then when you finally find out, you know, who the killer is, it's almost more unnerving because of how close they were to Sydney, you know. So I don't know, maybe it's a guessing game with your readers, like you don't want to lie to them, but it's okay to drop a red herring here and there, a little misdirection, you know. I don't know, I just write down and think what would scare me, and then I just go from there.
Seeing as how we have a writer of vampires amongst us, looking at
cool.
You, Martin, it's just I find it interesting that like science fiction writers don't have to worry about other people appropriating their tools, so to speak, because you know, if you appropriate the spaceship, you are writing a sci-fi. So. But horror writers kind of got sacked. Like, they got vampires taken away and werewolves and made it into something that's not primarily horror. I would love to hear both of your views on that, because, you know, one of you is on the receiving end and the other is like Martin, you don't write horror, but you do write vampires, which are traditionally horror characters. So this, I think it's an interesting dynamic, and I would love to hear what you guys think.
Listen,
about
I did none of the taking, all right? Vampires were already in urban fantasy by the time I got here, so get off my back.
Oh, man. God, I would almost say, I mean, just so you write urban fantasy vampire stories?
Urban fantasy, so it's in a sort of modern setting.
Yeah. So, I think there's an element of horror to that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I would have to read your work, but I don't think it's fair to say that urban fantasy is so far removed from horror. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I certainly agree that it can be, depending on the writer and the way they do that. I wouldn't say mine were very close to being horror at all. I don't know, I can't really say from the point of a reader. I think Greg's read my stuff, poor guy.
No, but your vampires don't, like, they don't exist to instill fear, as opposed to, you know, someone who writes horror with vampires who are, like, not the protagonists, or even if they are, it's a different focus. And it's just interesting to me that right now I can't think of any genre that got robbed, so to speak, as much as horror did.
Yeah.
Like, because of the Twilight books and movies, like, oh,
those two, oof. Yeah.
Oof.
I think, from a personal standpoint, my partner and I have been watching a variety of YouTube videos that talk about and analyze certain things and certain types of shows that came out after Twilight. Mm-hmm. I can't even bear saying the name of that. I really can't. Anyway, but yeah, the sudden arrival of those books and the subsequent films, which were as bad as each other, then created these bastard children TV shows. You know, you've got things like
Vampire Diaries.
Yeah, and things like that. And it's just drawn the concept of vampires even further out of the horror setting.
Yeah.
Let's talk about one of, if not the original vampire story, Dracula.
Yeah.
The original Dracula, written by Bram Stoker. I've read that book, or at least nearly all of it. And it was creepy. It was sinister. It was brilliant, even given how really old it is.
Yeah.
It was actually a very good story. And Dracula as an antagonist was a dark and sinister creature. Really not very nice at all. And it lent the whole book an eerie and sinister feel.
Yeah.
And then we get Twilight.
Yeah.
And vampires have gone from being these eerie, sinister things to being beings that have this kind of sexiness about them.
Yeah, I think Anne Rice kind of made him sexy with an Interview with a Vampire. But,
yes. But they were just one in between. Thank you very much.
But they were still monsters, you know? I mean, they were still they were still scary. And then, mm-hmm. Twilight comes along, and I wonder if part of it is, like in comics, how many times have we seen villains become the heroes, right? Like, you look at like Harley Quinn, or you look at Deadpool. And I wonder if it's just society wants to neuter everything that they're scared of. So
that's a good thought. Yeah.
Well, but if they have to do it with fucking Twilight, I mean, part of the reason why I wrote my vampire stories was to show people that they can actually be written halfway decently.
Right. Oh, one of my friends. So I used to teach ninth grade English, you guys. And this was years ago. And one year, I come into
class. Sorry, just a second. Sorry to interrupt you. But for those of us who are on this side of the Atlantic, what age is ninth grade?
Oh, sorry. That's like 14, 15.
Right. Now we're with you.
Okay. So I'm teaching these 14, 15 year olds. And I don't know if you know anything about teenagers, but they're dumb and they don't like to read.
And absolutely hate teenagers. Glad I never was one.
Me too. And so one year I come into class, beginning of the school year, and all these girls are reading this book, Twilight. And I was like, what is this? You're all reading. What has happened? And so I read it, and one of my friends read it too. And, she actually does the podcast that I do. She does it with me. We read it, and it is legitimately like poorly written. Like, not not just you know, sparkly vampires, like what is that about, but like just from a sentence structure and grammar standpoint, it's, and I don't care if I sound like a snob, but it is just, it's bad.
Yeah, absolutely.
I, from what I've heard, the characters aren't exactly written particularly brilliantly either.
Yeah. Well, what my friend calls it, abstinence porn, is what he said it is. Because you know they never have sex until like the very last book, and I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but see what I did there.
That's just terrible. I actually once came across one of the best brief descriptions for the Twilight series ever, and it was something along the lines of one girl's constant indecision between choosing necrophilia and bestiality.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that too, and yeah.
Oh my god. Yeah. But you know, I can imagine the manuscript came into an editor, an agent or whatever, and they just saw dollar signs in their eyes, you know, like the teenage girls are going to eat this up. It doesn't matter how poorly written it is. And, you know, they laughed all the way to the bank. And yeah, can you really fault them for that? I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, you know, it got people kind of interested in reading again. A little bit like Harry Potter, which as a counterpoint is written brilliant.
Yeah.
So for that, you know, we can thank Stephanie Meyer. And it got it gave a healthy boost to the genre. Well, so you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
If that was needed, fine.
Mm-hmm. And I do have former students that started with Twilight and are now, you know, reading, you know, good books. So it's if that's what it takes, you're right. That's fine. Anything to get people to read nowadays, right?
Yeah, Twilight is a sufficiently low bar of entry. literally anything that comes, you know, like they like it, great, they want to read something else, chances are it's better. So the only way is up.
Oh, that's true. You know, I have to tell you guys, today in the United States is Thanksgiving. I don't know if you... You know, that's Thanksgiving today, the day.
Oh yeah, happy Thanksgiving indeed.
Hey, thank you. A lot of states are, or I don't know if it's happened anywhere officially yet, but Indigenous Peoples Day, trying to get it, you know, taken away.
Oh,
from the...
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it's Thanksgiving, and so I'm the cook in my family. I made dinner all day, and while I'm making food, I'm drinking mimosas. So If I get a little inappropriate, or if I slur a little bit and I need to repeat myself, just let me know.
This entire podcast is inappropriate, so I wouldn't worry about it.
Now that you mention it, maybe drinking would you know, make hosting this thing with Martin more bearable.
Seriously. Greg, if we were drinking every time, you know, one of us got a little too difficult, I would be drunk 5 minutes in.
I have no idea what you're talking about. But moving on.
Sure, mister. I'll just talk for half an hour straight and not give Martin a chance to even get a word in edgeways. You are sorry, but it's happened.
You guys got to figure this out.
we will see a therapist or something.
Okay.
So, Martin, before I move on
to
the more interesting stuff, at least for me, because I'm not a big horror guy. So I read the basics of horror, but I'm not that into the genre. Partially because there is so much like low quality stuff out there that it kind of makes me pause before I dive into it. But you are closer to this, so anything you want to add or ask?
Actually, yes. I did have a question that kind of occurred to me as we were talking. So, Aaron, I don't know if you've come across the same saying or comment that I have, but there's a saying I've seen recently, which is, if it doesn't scare you, it won't scare the reader.
So, okay.
I was wondering, has there been occasions where you've written things that have scared you a bit as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, I have, of all the monsters that I know of or have read books about or written things about or watched movies about, I've always been really really scared of zombies. I don't know why. Like, I have a legitimate fear. Like, the whole concept of zombies just unnerves me. Okay? I just don't like them. I still I'll watch zombie movies, I'll read zombie books. You know, I read The Walking Dead. Don't watch the TV show so much these days, but hey, hello. Oh, there we go. But they scare me. And so for NaNoWriMo, like, I don't know when it was. It was a while ago. I was like, I'm gonna cure myself of this fear, and I wrote a zombie book, and I failed miserably of curing myself of that fear. The zombie book got published, which was cool, but I'm still
nice.
Yeah, the concept is just, I don't know what it is more than anything else. It just scares me.
Well, facing your fears almost never works out.
Like, right.
I have a fear of spiders. I decided to face it and sat down to watch Arachnophobia. Oh. It got worse. Speaking of horror, like, it's that's a brilliant movie, not necessarily from a technical standpoint, but definitely it got the job done and scared me shitless.
Yes, and I'm not even that scared of spiders. I mean, I don't like them, but which is weird that I love Spider-Man. But yeah, that movie is. And my wife is absolutely mortified by it. She can't even watch it. Like, it makes her cry. Like, it's so scary.
Martin, you're still here?
Uh-oh. Did we lose him? What do we do now?
Well, I don't know. We just keep talking, and I will ping him on Twitter.
Okay.
Oh, but I'm still
here. Hey, oh. There he is.
Okay.
I didn't go anywhere. I didn't do anything.
Well, you didn't respond, and I was worried.
But I did respond. You said, was I still here? And I said, yes, I'm still here.
Yeah, like 3 minutes later. Anyway.
don't start arguing with me, boy.
So yeah, I've scared myself writing before. How about you? Have you?
Cool. I wouldn't say scared, but I've certainly disturbed myself.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
On the heels of that question, is it like, are you scared while you're writing, because or are you scared when you're reading it back and you realize that, is this stuff really in my head? And that's just disturbing, or I don't know, surprising, or whatever. So, you know, or well, do you like set out to, I'm gonna, I don't know, write about the thing that scares me, and you go in like defining the thing?
Well, that's like with my book Former, I went in Like, I knew this was going to scare me, but like I said, my goal was to overcome the fear, and like I said, it failed miserably. But most of the time for me, when I'm writing, like the first draft, it's, I just spit it out, right? I sit at my keyboard or my notebook and I just write. And most of it is going to end up in the trash, right? That's not the part that scares me. It's when I go back to start editing, and I'm a firm believer that that's where, in most cases, that's where the art is in the editing. And so when I go in and start editing and I think of things that would make it even more scary, even scarier or disturbing, those thoughts like, oh my God, did I just really think of that? That's terrible. Why would I think of that?
Yeah.
Yeah, and there have been times later when I have, like, given myself nightmares and, you know, I'll have to get up and walk around the house for a little bit, cool down. So a little column A, a little column B for me, I guess.
And who do you, like, do you read outside your genre or kind of staying inside the horror scene?
Oh, no, I read everything. Right now I'm reading a science fiction book by Harry Harrison called West of Eden. Have you heard of that? It's pretty old. And it's about what if a meteor never killed off the dinosaurs and they like evolved, and it's science fiction. It's good. And I read the comic book Usagi Yojimbo.
Oh yeah, that's great.
It's fantastic. I love it. It's probably my favorite. Regularly, so I read that regularly. I don't read just one genre. I think that's a recipe for disaster from a creative level. You know,
yeah.
I like to read whatever. I mean, one of my favorite books of all time is Great Expectations, which. About as far away from horror or any genre writing as you can get.
Staying close a little bit to horror, and like I said, I don't really know the genre, because anytime I try to get into it, I run into some god awful things. Can you recommend a few books for someone who wants to get into it, and beyond like the obvious, like Stephen King, because that's kind of a given, but some good ones that may not be as evident as one would think.
Absolutely. Have you ever heard of Meddling Kids by Edgar Cantero?
Oh yes, I have seen it. I haven't read it.
Oh, it's good. It's simultaneously parodies and pays homage to Scooby-Doo and H.P. Lovecraft. Like, I mean, it's good. And I have a book. I don't know if it's considered horror. But the Raw Shark Texts by Stephen Hall, I would consider it horror. I don't know if that's where it's put in the bookstores or the libraries. House of Leaves by Daniel Uski. I can't remember his first name. House of Leaves by Mark Daniel Uski. It's about a house that's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside, which spend a little time thinking about that, and that's pretty terrifying, you know?
Yeah.
It just means that it was created by a Time Lord, blatantly.
So those are pretty disturbing. Of course, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, those kids' books, put together by Schwartz. I'm looking at it. What is his first name? Alvin Schwartz. Short stories. He kind of, if I remember right, he he went about writing it the same way that like the Brothers Grimm wrote all their fairy tales, just kind of went around and got folk tales and put them all together. And some of them are just silly, but some of them are like, oh my God, I can't believe this was in my elementary school library. This is terrifying.
Yeah, the Grimm brothers are straight up horror at least.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, those are some. Toni Morrison, I don't think her work is considered horror, but some scary stuff in a lot of them.
Yeah. Martin, any favorite horror books? Beyond Twilight. That's a different kind of horror.
I've not really read much in the way of horror. There was an author that my ex was quite into, James Herbert. Apparently, his work was pretty good horror.
Okay.
But I'm gonna write this down.
That's probably the only one that I know of.
And my, like, as we talked, I was thinking about kind of how horror works or what kind of effect it has on people. I read The Dark Fantasy by Raymond E. Feist, the fairy tale, which just made, like, it's dark fantasy and it's sort of urban fantasy by way of genre, but it made my skin crawl and just made me uncomfortable. And that was a job well done, and I would recommend it to everybody because it was just elementally scary.
What's it called again? I'm gonna write this down.
Fairy Tale by Raymond E. Feist. He usually writes like epic fantasy, The Rift World. It gave me a series, and now he has some new books. But that one book that's set in a modern world, like interlaced with Irish or Celtic fairy folklore, and is just scary as hell. Before I move on, one last question about the horror genre. About your offhand comment about one of the books you mentioned is the scary stories you tell around the campfire. Do you think that still works? Can you tell, like, can you scare people by telling scary stories around the campfire?
I think so. I think if the mood is right, you can do it. As an example, my parents live like 5 hours. It's like a 5 hour long drive to where they live. And a couple years ago, I was driving my kids down to see them, and they were like, "Dad, tell us a story. We want a scary story." And I was like, "Okay." I told them a story, and I'll be damned if I didn't give them both nightmares. I mean, like, I didn't intend to, but I thought it would be, this is kind of scary, but by the time I was done, my daughter was like, "I didn't like that story."
Well, so there is the you know, when you ask your a scout troop leader to tell a scary story over in the campfire, and then it's a whole other thing when you ask a horror writer to tell a scary story.
Yeah, that was their mistake.
So the other topic I really wanted to touch on, because it was such a nice surprise. Like I said, I browsed through your website, and it was so good to see that you are active in so many things. Like you write prose, you do graphic novels, you do short films, I really wanted to get your take on like standing on multiple legs and kind of transitioning from one medium to another, and what are the things that are the same across all kinds of stuff, the essence of storytelling, so to speak, and how do you kind of switch your brain around to accommodate each specific medium?
Well, that's a good question. And and I teach journalism, so I know. Well, I think across the board, no matter what medium you're working in, whether you're writing a comic book or a horror story or an epic fantasy or a short film, whatever, a good story is a good story. And the heart of any good story is the characters.
Mm-hmm.
So if your characters are real people, then chances are your story's going to be good. And I think that's what I look for when I'm like, if I don't like something and I'm not sure why, like, you know, you ever read something or watch something, and you're just like, I'm just not feeling this. I don't know what it is, but I don't like it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Chances are it's the characters. The characters are not real. And I think that ends a story faster than anything. That kills a story faster than anything. So if you keep your characters real and let them do what they're going to do because they're real, then you're probably going to get a good story no matter what genre you're working in.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's great. Pretty good advice.
Oh, well, thank you. But, you know, I mean, I've edited memoirs, and I've edited horror books, and I've edited fantasy. And I mean, the one thing that is true across every book that I have had a hand in, I like to think, is that the characters are real. They're real people. And yeah, that's what makes it good. Real people in crazy situations.
Like when you move from prose to graphic novel or from short film to to prose, do you find that does it like do you have to consciously switch to the new medium, or is it kind of seamless?
No, there's definitely a conscious effort to it. You know, I learned how to read with comics, and I've read comics since I can remember. So, like, my brain works that way. Like, I see panels and all that stuff. So I have to make a conscious effort. It's funny because I have to particularly make a conscious effort when I'm writing a script for a screenplay, because when I'm writing a script for a comic book, I write fairly descriptive descriptions of like what's going on in the panel, you know. Yeah. Like, okay, Spider-Man's over here and this is happening. When you're writing a script for a film, I've learned directors don't like to be told what's going on in the scene. They like to figure it out for themselves. So like, I make a conscious effort to pull back in my writing when I'm doing a screenplay. You know what I mean? Like, I don't describe everything. And yeah, it's not like I describe every single thing when I'm writing a comic book panel, but like, I leave it up to the directors. Like, they want to have their hand in it too, which makes sense because, you know, screenplay is not the finished product. I guess neither is a comic book script, but I think even more so, a screenplay is not the finished product. Mm-hmm. Lots of hands. So yeah, there is definitely a conscious effort to do it one way or another.
And do you think that working in so many mediums or media, as it's the proper plural of medium, does one enhance the other, or do you like find different insights just by switching perspective or working in a different medium, and then, you know, an insight comes that, yeah, this might work, or this definitely wouldn't work in the other.
Oh,
what's
yeah.
What's the relationship between those?
Well, you know, I'm a jack of all trades, master of none, so I don't know. how good I am at answering this, but yeah, I think you know, there's lots of stuff that's not gonna work in script writing, comic book or screenplay, that just works in prose, because, you know, you can really get inside the characters in a way that you just can't do it in comic books and prose. And another thing that is seems kind of simple, but I think it's a mistake all of us make when we're writing comics, and I teach students this all the time, to remember that a panel in a comic book is stationary, like that. you have to remember that, like, a character can't get out of bed, walk to the door, open the door, drink a cup of coffee, and say hello all in one panel, which is, you could do that in one scene in a movie, you can't, or in one shot in a movie, but you can't do that in one panel. And I know it seems like really technical, but that's the stuff that I've learned in both doing it and teaching it, is hard to remember. That makes sense.
Yeah, that's definitely what I was thinking. I'm reading a game design book that kind of breaks down game design theory into its very elemental parts, and at the core, it's the same kind of storytelling. It's tension and release. It's the structure of rising emotions and all that stuff, and it's always the little things and the dynamics between the parts that change, but at the core, it's character, it's emotion, telling a good story, and yeah, definitely, it's as a practitioner of that, you reinforce me in that.
Cool.
So, Martin, when that book deal, movie deal of yours comes in, and you are supervising the movie, just keep in mind that some things don't translate well from the page.
I'm completely aware of that. I'll make sure that whoever's directing the movie of my book, yeah, is aware of the fact that I want to be involved, but I know where my limits are.
But it's actually very interesting, because Aaron, you are the kind of the first screenwriter who says that they want to leave stuff to the director and the cinematographer. Literally everybody else I spoke to or read interviews with said that they always sit down and they not just write, they direct while they write, and they are very particular about how it should be filmed. And you know, anecdotally, a lot of screenwriters become directors because they are tired of directors butchering their scripts. But you know, that's just because that feels like the majority opinion. It doesn't necessarily has to be the right one or the only one. And what you said is actually, I think it's very, it's really awesome that filmmaking is a collaborative medium, and just knowing that there are lines that you wouldn't cross because you don't want to get involved in somebody else's discipline, that's great.
And I think it probably, for me, it probably comes from teaching this stuff for so long. Mm-hmm. You know, you observe what is going on in the classroom, and it's basically just a microcosm of, you know, what's going on out in the real world. You see these students get worked up about their scripts, and well, this is how it's got to be filmed, and sometimes it just can't be filmed that way. Like it just can't. Like there's, and I like to leave it open and see what will come of it. You know what I mean? And you know, I've made a lot of my own films, and so it's easy for me to say because I'm the director that I've worked with, and any other director that I've worked with has been a friend. Mm-hmm. So having them like be like, well, I want to do it this way, it's like, okay, cool, try it, see what happens. I've never worked with someone that's just a business associate, so I don't know how I would react in a situation like that. I'd like to think I'd be, you know, pretty chill, but who knows? Who's to say?
Yeah.
You never know how you're going to react until you're in the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then again, directors are usually, you know, creative people, and it's a creative effort when the pushback is probably from the studio, because the big nuclear explosion that wipes out the zombies is just, you know, $3.5 million, and you have a budget of $100,000.
Yeah.
We are approaching the 1 hour mark, which
we are
usually signals us that we should let our guest go. And
okay,
Martin, anything to add or ask before you sign off?
No, not particularly. No, I've got nothing else to add.
Okay, then...
Nothing relevant, anyway.
Then let me thank Aaron for his time again, and I will let my unnaturally unverbose co-host... that's why we make such a good pair, because we are opposites of each other. I will let him do the outro.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's been fun.
Yeah, it was. Thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah.
Anytime.
It's definitely been a blast.
Yeah.
Okay. This is that's pretty much been everything for tonight. As per usual, all of the relevant links and information will be in the show notes. You can also contact us through our usual channels. All of us are on Twitter. Individually, and also you can contact us through the @writerings account. We also have email available, so if you want to drop us an email, it is writerings.podcast@gmail.com. drop us a line anytime you're able to, anytime you like. Give us a shout, just to let us know how you think the show's going, any ideas you might have for how we can progress, what you think of what we're doing. Just any kind of feedback you want to give us. Don't forget to rate us on pretty much anywhere you can get a podcast. iTunes, the other ones, I don't know what they are. I don't listen to podcasts usually.
that's the purity of innocence. We do this purity of innocence.
Absolutely, and we're completely unbiased as well.
Right.
And also, why not drop us a voice message on Anchor, which is something else you can do. It's a great feature. Nobody's ever done it for us, but yeah, you can be the first. And yeah, I think that's everything. I don't think I've left anything.
Share the podcast with your friends.
Yes.
If you like it. Like us. If you don't like it, share it with your enemies.
I listened to a couple of the episodes. You guys are good. I like this. This is good stuff.
Wait, thank you.
Well, thank you. I guess it just remains for us to say, I have been Martin. This has been Greg, and he talks far too much, so he's not going to say anything now. And also our fantastic guest, Aaron, who has just been absolutely incredible, and we thank him very much.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much, and we will talk to you next week.
All right, bye.
Bye.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.